This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of Between Me and You by Allison Wynn Scotch, performed by Julia Whalen and Tim Campbell. For anyone brave enough to fall in love. Nobody has ever measured, not even poets, how much the heart can hold. Zelda Fitzgerald.
1. Ben. November 2016. Now. I told myself that if she showed, that would be the sign I needed. If she showed, maybe we could find a way to rewind, rewrite, do it all over. Do it all better. Do it all again, only differently. It's silly. It's something out of a Hollywood ending, and I'd know that better than most. It's not how I'd write it, but it's how the studio would want it, what would appeal to the demographic they were courting. Men will want to go home and screw their wives, call their girlfriends. Women will weep and know that love conquers all. I snort to myself, though it's lost in the bluster of the wind. The squeal of a motorcycle racing too quickly down Ocean Avenue. Empty on this overcast Sunday morning. Did I ever believe that? Did I ever pin my hopes that love could conquer all? It feels like so long ago. When we met each other. When we loved each other without conditions. A familiar tornado of grief spins inside me. Though it's not just grief for her. It's for both of us. For me, too. How naive we were. How we lost ourselves to so many things. Her career. Mine for a while. Joey. Our mourning. Everything that piled up to be the weight of too much. Me more than her, I suppose. Though I never admitted this aloud. It was easier to point fingers. Make her feel responsible, even though I know, if I peel back enough layers to my core, that I was equally so. More than equal. She was always sturdier than I was. Elusive in the way that an actress needs to be. Permeable, which also made her more adaptable to all the shit that came our way. I was who I was. Always had been. And hadn't been able to adapt. To duck right when a left punch was thrown. To duck left when the right one came at me, too. But still, maybe today we can right ourselves. We can. We have to. I say this aloud, against the wind. As if putting it out into the universe, here where the earth drives into the sea, makes it true. We can right ourselves. It's so romantic, so unlike who I've become, that I'm surprised to discover how much I believe it, how much I mean it, how much I need it. I need her. I want her. My stomach turns at the notion of just how badly I do. I've staked our future on her showing, which is presumptuous and also dumb, since I have conveyed none of this to her. But she knows where to find me. Knows exactly where I'll be. I check the time on my phone. Not that I've told her I'd be here. Like a stupid script, some dumb chick flick, I'm throwing it to fate. If she shows, we'll give it another go. Call off the lawyers, which she said she didn't really want anyway. Did I want them? A year ago, I was certain, but bruises fade until you can't detect them across your healed skin. And now, even when I search for those welts, I find I'm unable to see them. Feel them, yes. Sometimes, if I press myself in the right places, I can still feel them. But that's probably the point. That you can still detect the pain, but don't have a constant reminder. That's the only way to fix us. This is where you hurt me. Please don't do it again. So here I am, casting about, looking for the familiar bounce of her step, the way her hair fans back and forth as she walks, the way her spine points exactly north with perfect posture, thanks to endless years of Pilates and yoga and whatever else the studio pays for and implores her to do. I lean over the white picket fence that lines the park's running path, tilt toward the ledge below, the drop-off that crescents into the beach, then the vast expanse of ocean. When we first moved here, we lived just around the corner, in a one-bedroom bungalow that felt made for us. We'd stumble down this same path on the weekend mornings, hands linked towards the farmer's market, or for a beckoning cup of coffee. She'd be exhausted from a late-night shift at the bar, and I'd be wired from a night of riding too late. I press my palms against the fence, straighten out, then head down the sun-bleached steps toward the water, the air swirling and smelling of salt and nostalgia. She'll notify me down here, where I always am on his birthday, where something beckons me year after year, as if this ritual brings me peace. She'll come, I tell myself. She has to. I need her to. The beach is mostly deserted. It's too cold to swim, and the sun is battling a swath of thick clouds that won't dissipate until late afternoon, just before sunset, when it's too late to enjoy the beach anyway. There are a few lone surfers bundled in their rubber wetsuits, a determined jogger every now and then. I kick off my flip-flops by the concrete path's edge, then step onto the sand, my arches and heels leaving imprints, tracks, as I go. We always used to do this, take morning beach walks in those heady early days of our marriage. We never had a destination or an end point in mind. We simply walked to keep each other company, talking for hours. Sometimes my calves would be sore the next day. I shook my head. I haven't thought about all of this for ages, years. Jesus. Somehow, between those days when the sunrises melted into the sunsets, and now, we got here. Here. I blow out my breath, remembering New Year's, remembering Sundance, remembering Joey's birth, remembering the lot of it. We weren't always split in two. We weren't always beyond repair. My feet are in the chilly seawater now, sending a jolt up through my ankles, to my calves, my thighs, nearly to my heart. I stretch my arms upward like I'm offering myself to the gods of the ocean. It's not the first time I've considered it, swimming as far out as possible, seeing what happens from there. But I'm not brave like Leo. I reconsider. I'm not reckless like Leo either. I find a pack of old cigarettes in my pocket. I've never enjoyed smoking. How it makes me lightheaded, it's disgusting aftertaste. That it will slowly kill me. For a while there, I didn't care, though. Now, I'm wiser. Now, maybe, I'm more hopeful. So I raise an unlit cigarette to my mouth, let it linger because I like its heft, but not its consequences. Like so many things in my life, I've learned to straddle the middle and just try to get out alive. A lithe blonde surfer swims in, just a hiccup down from me, shaking the water off, then offering a little wave. I drop the cigarette back into the pack, then smile back, wondering if she means to wave at me, if this lithe blonde surfer has mistaken me for someone else. Not that I'm so bad, not for 42. Which is midlife in theory, but here in Los Angeles could really be an extension of prolonged adolescence. Hell, some of my friends still haven't married. A few still run around with starlets in their lower 20s. Especially those who've done well for themselves. Drive the Porsche, have a spread with a view in the hills. Sometimes they'll ping me and say, "Come out, dude. Let's roll. Let's score." But none of that feels important like it used to. The Porsche, the house made of glass in the hills. Initially, in those first few early months of being single, sure, well, who wouldn't find that liberating? Now I just want her, our old life. "Hey," I say to the surfer, "nice morning for the waves." I self-consciously run my fingers over my dark stubble that is peppered with a tiny bit of gray. "Killer," she says, "the best." and then lofts her board under her arm and glides away toward the parking lot. See ya. I peer around. The beach is deserted again. She's not coming. I lose my breath for a beat, punched in the gut with the realization. I actually believed that she was as hopeful as I was, that she was willing to forget how broken we'd become. Dumb, 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 I mutter aloud. It was a stupid bet I'd made with myself, a stupid way out from the corner we've backed ourselves into. The Hollywood ending. But Hollywood endings aren't really life, aren't anything more than what I'd type into a draft before hitting the end. My dad always told me that I was too romantic. Being a writer, he'd scoff, not exactly what we had planned for you. He'd pour himself a scotch, adjust his tie, and gaze at me in the way that I could read only as disappointment. As if anyone's plans for anyone else can set their path. The same lesson I learned with Leo, and the irony isn't lost on me. I should have said that to him then. I should have known better. Do what you want. Do what you love. Be happy. Instead, I lived to whittle down my young romanticism to prove my dad wrong. To show him that I had mettle, the grit wasn't lost on me. Even if I wanted to spend my days concocting fictional characters who allowed me to lose myself in other places, other worlds. The wind kicks up, blowing the salty air over me, and I inhale deeply enough that my chest puffs up, and then I squeeze my eyes shut and remember why I came here this morning. I came here not just in hopes of seeing her, but to remember him, too. How much he loved the ocean. How he wanted to retire here and surf. I should have told him to, but how was I to know? How was any of us to know? I'd have done it differently, you know, I say aloud. To him, to her, to myself, too. No one answers, of course. Just the continuous beat of the waves breaking in front of me. The ever-present swirl of the wind. If I could go back and do it all differently, I would. I turn and head back to the concrete path where I abandoned my flip-flops. A figure is running down the path in the distance. My gut spins, an honest mix of elation and nerves. But then I see the red hair and a ponytail flopping back and forth. I squint because I wonder if my brain is playing a trick on me, that I'm seeing something, a mirage that isn't really there. But then she's in front of me, startled a bit herself, out of breath, sweat running behind her ears. Ben, she says. Oh my gosh, hey. Hey. I lean forward and kiss her damp cheek. I didn't... My heart races. My brain goes to static. Amanda. Not at all whom I was expecting. Not at all whom I'm ready for. I have to apologize for a million things, I'm sure. I stutter again. I was prepared to make a speech, to get down and beg for absolution. And yet... She isn't here, and Amanda is, smiling and seemingly open, and my pulse is hammering so quickly that I don't know how I'm still standing. Maybe this is the sign, that romantic one in the movies that the audience is clutching their seats and waiting for with their hearts in their throats. Even as I hear myself think that, I'm not sure I believe it, but what the hell? My mind refocuses on how good she looks. On how lovely she smells, on how something lights inside of me that feels a little feral, a little wild, like it used to whenever I saw her, even when we shouldn't have been seeing each other at all. God, Amanda, it's been forever, I say. She laughs. Not forever. What, a year or two? She smiles. Okay, I know exactly how long it's been. Since May last year. 18 months. That seems right. I hesitate. You don't hate me. She smiles again, easily. It was all a mess. So, no, I don't hate you. I nod, unsure of what to say next. I know what I came here for, but like so many things recently, I find that I'm willing to abandon my principles because they're inconvenient. Write a shitty script? Sure. Leave with a different woman? Why not? I unexpectedly think of my dad again. Fuck you, I want to tell him. And how disappointed he'd be with this sliding scale. I remembered what today was. Amanda's already pink cheeks turn redder, nearly matching her hair, and I push my dad out of my thoughts.
I thought you might be here. Remembered how you told me you'd do this.
She shrugs.
God, that sounds like a stalker thing to do. Really, I run down here most mornings. I thought you might be here today.
My brain is playing catch-up, assessing this unforeseen turn. Amanda showed. Tatum did not. I determined that this has to mean something, even if it's not what I wanted it to mean when I woke this morning and resolved to win back my wife. Finally, I say, amazing how you knew. Of course I'd be here. I'm glad you found me.
2. Tatum. October 1999. I made a bet with Daisy that I could get at least 3 numbers by midnight. It's not something I do normally, this bet, these numbers, but she is pushing me outside of my comfort zone, part of an acting exercise assigned to us by Professor Sherman. Move past your comfort zone into that sticky territory of inhabiting someone else. And so I agree. Besides, it's better than deflecting the cheesy pickup lines that come with being a bartender, the lecherous looks of patrons who somehow think you're up for grabs, the self-criticism that would otherwise clang around my easily infected brain. By playing the part, slipping into a role, it's easier to step outside myself. That's half the reason I want to be an actor in the first place. I can be anyone I want to be. So, of course, I said yes to the bet. They can't be trolls, guys you'd never go out with to begin with, Daisy said, pouring a shot of whiskey down her throat, untying her black apron and passing it to me when we swapped shifts. I knotted it around my own waist as we traded places, me behind the bar, her on a rickety stool in front of it. Got it, I said, nodding. No trolls. And no drunks. She held up a finger, then another. So no trolls and no drunks, because then it's too easy. Because then you'd get, like, 3 numbers in 3 minutes. I laughed. You're overestimating my appeal. Shut up, she said, and wrapped her blonde hair into a bun at the nape of her neck. Don't do that. Do what? That thing you do. Act like you're not worth it. Act like you don't deserve it. She leaned over the bar and poured herself another shot. Besides, this is supposed to be fun. This is supposed to be about making them believe you are whoever you want to be. So it's about the chase, I said. Well, and about the assignment. Here's to the chase, she replied, and flipped her empty shot glass over against the wooden bar. And maybe some sexy-ass men. Here's to that. I laughed, because why not? So now it's 11:47, and I have one more number to go when I see him at the end of the bar, nursing a beer, which I hadn't poured for him, which tells me that he ordered it before I came on my 11 p.m. shift. 1 beer over the course of an hour. A lightweight. A sipper. Probably a bit of a geek. Not unlike me when I'm not donning whichever mask I'm assigned for the day or the evening. Non-threatening. I like making these assumptions. It helps me compartmentalize who he is, who I might have to be in reaction to that. Like a casting call. We are seeking a non-threatening kind of geek, who is also cute, to play off the role of a man-eater bartender, who is also pretty, in a generic way. I grab the dirty rag and wipe down the countertop, making my way toward the corner. 3 undergrads, definitely not legal, push their way toward me and snap their fingers to get my attention. My cheeks blaze with something like lower-middle-class embarrassment, but it's dark, and I'm not me right now, so I flush that inbred shame away. These girls, they're all the same. NYU rich kids who come to dive in with their parents' credit cards or their $100 bills and act like the world is imploding when they're not immediately served their vodka twists. Outside of the bar, outside of this role that I slip into, these types of girls make me duck my head, dart around them on the street. They are better than me in ways that seem inexplicable, unattainable. But here, In this bar, on my turf, with my apron as a sort of shield, they are my adversary. "Excuse me," one of them shouts, then snaps again. "Don't snap at me," I say, my decibel level stronger than my will. "I'm not your goddamn dog." "What?" she says, possibly because she can't hear me over the stereo and the voices that are all raised to match the music, or possibly because she simply has never been spoken to in such a way. "Don't snap." I like the way that feels, this bravado. She recoils. "Oh my God, I just wanted a vodka tonic." "I need ID." I don't technically need ID since we pretty much serve anyone, bar policy, but I'm on a roll now, the distance widening between who I am outside of the bar and who I am behind it. Her head jerks back like I've slapped her, and her eyes skitter with fury. She leans over and whispers to her friend, then says, "The last lady served us no problem. Look." She holds up an empty glass. "I'm not the last lady," I shrug. I'm impressed with my swagger, feel very strongly that Professor Sherman would deem my performance true to life. "I left it in the booth, in my purse." I start wiping down the bar again, as if I'm already bored with this, easing my way toward phone number 3. "Hey, Freckles," she yells, referring, I imagine, to the band of freckles that run across my nose. "Don't you want a fucking tip?" At this, the guy at the end of the bar looks up from staring at the foam in his surely warm beer and watches us. "I'd love a tip," I say, "from someone who's 21. "Here's a tip," she shouts, standing taller on the foot of the stool, which is teetering, imbalanced. "You're working for me, back there, behind there. I am not working for you. Got that?" "Yeah?" I laugh, the blood rising to my cheeks again. I turn the other direction. "Got it loud and clear, but you're still not getting served." "Bitch!" she yells, just before the stool topples over and she disappears from my view, and there's a commotion on the floor as her friends huddle around her. My whole face is fire now. I can feel it, hot and shameful. But I squeeze my fingers together into tight fists and remind myself that tonight, I'm not who these girls want me to be. I'm not who anyone thinks I am. I am the part I promised Daisy I would play. I curl my hands into balls so tight, my knuckles clench and my nails dig into my palms. Then I release them and let the blood flush back into the recesses of my body. He's watching me, phone number 3, so I keep my eyes down, just scrubbing the spilled beer, wiping in concentric circles until I stop right in front of him. I check the clock above the exit. I have 7 minutes to lock him in. Win the bet. Ace Daisy's assignment.
"I hope you don't take her personally," he says, nudging his chin toward the hubbub by the fallen stool. "I went to high school with her older brother. I think being an asshole is genetic."
I laugh easily, like she hadn't just set off a grenade inside of me, and reach for his glass. "Free refill for you."
"I don't need one." He waves his hand. "I'm on my way out."
"You turn into a pumpkin before midnight?" He smiles, and he's cuter than I realized from afar. Straight nose, great teeth. Not that I'd taken him to be a troll, because trolls are off-limits per the rules of the game, but the shadows of the bar concealed his blue eyes, his defined chin, his strong shoulders.
"Nah, just... I have an early shoot tomorrow, and the person I was meeting tonight never showed."
"A shoot? I'm intrigued." I plop elbows onto the bar, bend my chin into my palms.
"Grad student," he says.
"Are you at Tisch? I've never seen you before. I'm there for theater."
"I'm there for writing, MFA," he says. "You know, about to set the world on fire as the next big screenwriter."
He shrugs, looks away.
"Or something like that. I don't know. Talk to my parents and they'll tell you I gave up my very lucrative analyst position at Morgan Stanley for a graduate degree in film."
"Banking boys are so boring. No wonder you quit." I grab the tap and refill his beer anyway, then slide it back to him. Tell your parents to screw themselves." He honest to God snorts at this.
"I'm still living with them, so that's a little hard."
Yikes, I say.
Tell me about it.
He sighs. Well, truthfully, I could probably never tell mine to screw themselves either. I admit. Sorry, bad advice. I'm trying something new tonight. I shake my head, refocus. I can already hear Professor Sherman chiding me for slipping so gracelessly out of character.
I thought bartenders only gave amazing advice.
Only in the movies. I laugh. You're shit out of luck with me. I wipe my hands on the towel, which is really more for show than hygiene, since it's damp with old booze and pretzel crumbs. I extend my right hand. Tatum Connolly.
Ben Livingston.
He clasps my palm more firmly than I expect, and I wince.
Sorry,
he says.
Habit. Trained that way by my dad since I was 6.
Fun childhood.
My dad's only paying for grad school on the promise that I win an Oscar.
So win an Oscar, I say.
Okay.
He grins.
Now you sound like him. If you're going to do something, Benjamin, you'd better at least be the best.
There are worse role models, I say, because God knows I know that there are.
I'm probably making it sound worse than it is.
He sips his beer.
You know, to make you feel sorry for me or something.
Fun childhoods are overrated, I say, because I would know. But because I already slipped once and I'm not about to betray any part of who I really am again and instead will conceal myself completely in who I need to be for the night, I add, but why would you want me to feel sorry for you? I bite my lip, coy, flirtatious, exactly what would be demanded of this role in this moment.
Oh, I don't know. So when you get my phone number, you might take pity on me and actually call,
he says. I chew on a swizzle stick to disguise my surprise at his forthrightness. What makes you think I want your phone number? And even if I did want your phone number, why then wouldn't I call? For your information, as a female bartender, I get numbers thrown at me all the time.
Well, good, because I don't hand out my number to strangers.
I'm not a stranger, I say. I'm Tatum. I wonder, briefly, if I should have made up a name, like Jocelyn or Tiffany or something else to go fully method in this conversation, but it's too late. More proof, I remind myself, that I need to hone my technique, need to work on really living the part, not just trying it on. Sherman is always saying that.
When you go, you have to go all in, or else the audience will pick apart your inconsistencies like hawks on a dead deer.
He literally said that, verbatim. He laughs.
But you don't want my number, Tatum, so we don't have anything to worry about.
Well, I don't want your number, in fact.
Perfect,
he says. Great, I reply. Then, well, what if I do want your number?
I already told you. I don't give my number out to strangers who scare me, knowing your name aside.
Something else you learned in your childhood?
They trained me well.
He raises his eyebrows, flirting. What if I'm not a stranger? I say. What if I tell you something about my own less-than-fun childhood that assures you that I'm just Tatum, your local friendly bartender? I wiggle my fingers in my best jazz hands and push my face into a showbiz-style grin. I spy the clock, less than a minute. Shit.
I'll consider it,
he says. I started working when I was 12, have had a job ever since, I say. So, no fun for me.
Nope.
Oh, come on, I say. Are you going to make me beg?
Yes, he says. I am going to make you beg. Very much so. Come on, give me your best begging face.
I stick my lip out and furrow my brow, folding my hands in front of me as if in prayer. Please, pretty, pretty, please. I hear Daisy cackling before I see her. Then she pops up on the stool next to him, shoulders shaking, tears in her eyes. What? I double-take. Were you, like, crouching underneath the bar, listening to this the whole time? She nods, laughing too hard to speak. What, judging my technique? I eye the clock. 12:01. I lost the bet, which doesn't mean much other than bragging rights, other than more proof that maybe Sherman is wrong about me, that I'm not the best one in the class.
Just ensuring that I won, she hiccups. Also, I wanted to witness Ben giving you shit because I knew it would be adorable. No, hilarious, actually. Nice, I say. Super nice. Then, to Ben, I take it you know her? Ben wrote a short about dating I did a few months ago, she says. I told him about our little pickup contest, and he wrote it into the script. That Women Are From Mars short? Ben nods. That won an award last semester, didn't it? He shrugs.
I just wrote the script. She starred. And the dude who directed it, another guy I grew up with, actually got the award.
All you fancy Manhattan kids, I say. The next Scorsese's. But you, don't do that. I jab his shoulder.
Do what?
Dismiss any notions of greatness. Act like you're not worthy of winning some award. I point at Daisy. She tells me that all the time, so now I'm telling you. Even in the dim light, I can see his face redden. He's not so different from me, outside of this bar. Uncertain, unsure. I'm serious, I say. Like, if that had been my film, I'd be standing on top of this bar, screaming about it with a microphone. He watches me, assessing, and for a moment I wonder if he's going to dare me to do so, put my money where my mouth is, prove him wrong, and jump on the counter and yell like a banshee. And I pray that he doesn't call me on this ridiculous bluster, because I can take part only so far before my self-awareness kicks in. But he checks his watch and glances toward the door, then fishes his wallet from his back pocket and flattens $40 on the wood paneling.
I should go. Looks like I'm getting stood up.
Well, that sucks. I grab a glass from below the bar and pour myself a beer, ignoring two borderline legal kids with backward baseball caps who are waving me down. And you don't owe me $40.
It's midnight, and you lost the bet, he says. A big tip, an actual tip, not a smart-ass tip from that girl who went to my high school, is the least I could do.
He hesitates.
Anyway, I actually feel kind of bad about setting you up to lose. I really never do things like that.
He points at Daisy.
She begged me. So I apologize, and please, take the tip.
I did, Daisy says, nodding. It was too perfect not to. But yes, she holds up her right hand. I can attest that Ben, whom I have known since childhood, is the rare breed of actually decent man who is not a total asshole.
Nice, he says.
She's not from here, Daisy interrupts. She's only very recently become acquainted with New York men. Ohio, I shrug. We only breed nice men in Ohio. Nice men who don't trick us into losing.
Thus the $40.
Ben inches the bills toward me. Well, I don't like losing. I frown. And I do like big tips.
No one really likes losing, he says. And I think everyone likes good tips.
Are you making fun of me?
No.
He holds his hand over his heart.
I swear I am not making fun of you, and I have Daisy to testify that I am indeed a non-asshole New York guy who wouldn't do that sort of thing.
We went to elementary together, she says. I've known him since forever. I suppose losing a bet and getting $40 is better than getting stood up, so my night is not quite as bad as yours, I admit. So, fine, I will see your $40 and raise you a tequila shot. On the house. I reach behind me for the cheap tequila that the undergrads are more than happy to overindulge in. I never do shots on the job, but it feels exactly like what the persona would do, so shots it is.
I'm not sure if I'm quite being stood up. It's complicated.
He sighs, and for a moment it's like I can see his whole childhood across his face, his aspirations, his disappointments, his hopes that he still pins himself to.
My girlfriend's in her third year of med school. She's just busy. Occupied, that's the word she uses. She's occupied all the time, saving lives and whatever, so, I mean, how can I argue with that?
Sounds like you need a new girlfriend, I say.
Probably, but I'm one for loyalty. I don't bail until the ship is sinking.
That look again. Nothing but naked openness, like he is still 11 and hasn't yet been jaded by the ways of the world. Meaning, you're loyal, but she might not be? He laughs.
What are you, like, my therapist, too?
So I couldn't have gotten your number even if I hadn't been set up by my so-called best friend. I slam 3 shot glasses down and dump the tequila in each. He shrugs and smiles.
Hey, Daisy put me up to it.
Well, I toss the shot back too quickly, and it burns all the way down. I guess you owe me one. I smile at him now as Tatum, not Tatum the bartender, not Tatum the brave. He smiles back as Ben.
Well, he says, I guess I do.
3. Ben. July 2015.
Constance is sick, Tatum says. Or else I'd have sent her to get him.
It was part of our separation agreement. That Constance, our nanny, would do most of the handoffs. Though we'd gotten more casual about it in the 4 months since I moved out. Tatum shrugs and stares at my pathetic doormat, which is gray and muddy and in need of a wash. But how do I wash a doormat? I don't even know. We both let our eyes linger on it for a beat too long. I'm throwing that out, I say, and point downward. I'm getting a new one later today. I don't know why I care about impressing her. I'm angry with her. I am untangling myself from her. Those are the words I use with Eric when he takes me out after work to nurse my wounds. He tells me to consider a real therapist, not my best friend from college who is now my producing partner, and he's not really good at advice for shit, especially since he is still single at 41 and trolling Tinder.
Okay, Tatum replies, though you could just wash it.
This irritates me, for no reason at all. Rather, it irritates me because of course she is right. I could simply wash it, which I just told myself 5 seconds earlier. But coming from her, it feels like proselytizing, not wise counsel. Like she's saying it just to be right. For fuck's sake, why is Tatum always right? Of course I can wash the stupid doormat. You don't have to point out my shitty doormat, I say. My eyes twitch when I realize that, in fact, I was the one who pointed out my shitty doormat in the first place. God, when am I going to stop being such an asshole just for the sake of it?
I wasn't. I just...
She stops, shakes her head.
I don't want to do this, Ben.
She checks the time on her phone.
Is he ready? I have a meeting in an hour.
Of course she has a meeting in an hour. Tatum's time is no longer her own. Hasn't been for years now. So let him stay longer. I'll watch him.
It's my day.
I soften. But you have a meeting, and Constance is out sick. Come on, Tate. We're having fun.
Ben...
She uses that impatient voice that I sometimes heard her use on set, when I used to visit, when someone would have the misfortune of suggesting a creative tidbit that was totally beneath her. For the most part, Tatum was accommodating, as far as A-listers go. No temper tantrums, no outrageous diva demands. But it wasn't as if she couldn't skewer you with a raised eyebrow, couldn't decimate your ego with one word.
Ben...
Also, it wasn't as if she didn't make plans without considering anyone else's schedule. Wasn't as if she hadn't grown used to everyone around her saying, yes, except for me. But I now live in a 2-bedroom apartment 2 miles away from the new house in Brentwood, so it's not working out so well on my end either. Tate, come on.
The therapist said that consistency is key, she says.
And it's true. The therapist we found for Joey to help him through the divorce had said that constancy, a united front, from us, was imperative. Joey had been moodier since we told him the news. Explosive mood swings from a previously docile child. Crying jags that felt unending, whereas he barely cried before. Even back when he'd broken his arm. Consistency, Dr. Cohn kept reiterating. Okay. I say, as she waits expectantly for a fight.
Okay.
She nods. I start to ask her who will be watching Joey. He's only 7 and can't stay by himself. But I realize the answer will only spark another fight. Tatum's father. To whom I have been unkind. Shamefully unkind, until it grew too late. Until Tatum and I each held our own scorecards, and he was one of the chits she was able to hold against me. Rightfully so. I chew my lip. I could apologize now. I could say, God, I was such a stubborn dick for reasons that were all about me. But she has never apologized for her own sins, so I'm not about to fall on my sword. Besides, attorneys have been consulted, retainers have been paid. Apologies are too long in coming and won't amount to much anyway. Joe, I call over my shoulder. Hurry up, Mom's here.
2 minutes, Daddy,
he calls back. Sorry, I say. We were knee-deep in Madden on the Xbox. Back over my shoulder, I shout, you better not be cheating, kiddo.
Tatum presses her mouth into a thin line, then removes her sunglasses and squeezes the bridge of her nose. This is her exasperated face, the one I usually see now. Even when it's simply because Joey is playing Madden for an extra 2 minutes. I'll get him, I say. Mostly as an escape from the unbearable discomfort between us. Not because I want him to leave me a second sooner than he has to. I'm alone so often now. Too often. All set. I reemerge with Joey and his bag that is filled with his dirty laundry from the past 2 nights. Shit. Am I going to get a passive-aggressive text about how I should have washed it? I hold my breath, and I can feel Tatum holding hers, too. We're both waiting for an explosion of Joey's tears, or a kick to my shin, or a fist to my side. Yelled protests that he doesn't want to go, or he doesn't want us to divorce, or just that he doesn't want something, anything. It doesn't have to be specific these days with him. Instead, he stands on his tiptoes and pecks my cheek, then wraps his arms around my neck. I loft him off his feet, and he giggles. I feel myself softening, glance at Tatum, who seems to uncoil too. Be good for your mom, kiddo, I say, before I set him down. And he reaches for Tatum's hand.
I'm always good for mommy,
he laughs, giggling like he used to, like he wasn't now being split in two. I watch them go, and know that I can't say the same. With Joey gone, the apartment is so quiet, so empty, I'm not sure what to do with myself. I play Madden to kill some time, but it's just pathetic to get worked up over fake football without your 7-year-old son there. I should work. I know that. Eric and I are back on set, managing the writer's room, breaking the story arcs for the next season of Code Emergency. But what I should really do is write. Like I used to. Like I know I can. Not managing a staff of exhausted 30-somethings, not crafting some bullshit hospital drama that I could outline while I sit on the can. I mill about my apartment, running my hands over the empty walls, pausing in corners, turning, starting again. Seeing her today, here, has rattled me. It's easier to pretend she doesn't still inhabit part of me when we go days or even weeks now without stepping close enough to touch. I might see her face on a magazine cover or flip past one of her movies on late-night cable, but it's not the same as breathing in the same air, smelling her faint perfume, the same custom scent from Barney she's worn for years, wanting to reach out and brush her arm when I think of something clever to say. I can hear her in my ear, telling me, like she always used to say, if you can dream it, you can be it. But I've been in hibernation for so long, screwed things up so deeply, that I'm not even sure what I dream. But slowly, I'm awakening. Slowly, I feel myself melting into something like my old self. Someone who once dreamed the same things she did. Who promised to write something for her, but then lost himself to other people's visions of what they wanted from him. I should write it now. Today. Even if she doesn't need me any longer. Maybe that's the best time, when she doesn't need me. Prove to her that I understood why she asked me all those years ago. Because we were better together. But instead, I keep walking from room to room in the apartment, and staring at the vacancy. Not that it's all that big, certainly nothing compared to the house in Brentwood with its high fences and higher ceilings, where Tatum now lives alone with Joey. The house that was meant to be our enclave. To protect her from the outside world, protect us from everything else. I let Joey pick out all the new furniture, decorate his room any which way he pleased. So his walls are a jarring bright green and his rug a shocking electric blue. But still, even with his bed unmade from the weekend, it feels barren. I haven't lived alone in 15, almost 16 years. I shut Joey's door without a sound, as if I might disturb anyone, though it will just be me until Joe heads back to me on Wednesday, when Tatum flies to London to scout for her next film, which, incidentally, she's also directing. I grab the scotch, my dad's old drink, from the kitchen counter, where I'd abandoned it earlier after my round of Madden, and refresh it. I down the glass in a single gulp. That helps. Helps numb me to all this shit and how fucked we are and how furious I still am even though we split up months ago. The rage isn't just about us. It's about so many other things, too. Things I need to let go of, but instead find myself venting about over beers with Eric. I know that makes me childish. I know I need to grow up. But at this moment, growing up feels overrated, especially when the scotch helps so very much. I tried grown up with Leo. Look how well that worked. I pour myself another because seeing her today has shaken me, and one more will ease me into forgetting how my pulse accelerated at the sight of her, how I wanted to reach out and grab her cheeks and press her against the wall and kiss her, but also how much I wanted to shake her shoulders and say, "You wronged me." She could just as easily do the same to me. I know. I know all of this. I suck down the shot, then run my finger around the lip of my glass, licking off the residue of the alcohol. I weave back into Joey's room, fall into his bed, where I've been sleeping during the nights he spends at Tatum's. He sometimes asks when I'm going to come home. Tatum thinks it's best that we just explain that we're not getting back together, that we have concise parameters of what to expect so he can mourn his old family unit and embrace a new one. She's probably right. She's always right. But I've been in this place for only 4 months. 4 months is nothing. 4 months is a sliver of time, when perhaps, like Joey, I can still make believe that we can be put back together. Which I do want some days. So I try to reassure him with vague platitudes, as if that reassures me, too. Maybe, even though we almost hate each other, we'll find our way back together. My promises sound as false to my own mind as they do when I try to offer reassurances aloud to Joey. "Ben," my mom said the other night when she called, as she does daily now, like she still worries about me even at 40. "Marriage is a series of small forgivenesses." I could hear Ron in the background, talking to one of their house guests. They bought a place in Sagaponack, mostly retired there now. "If you get caught up with one forgiveness, all the others you may need move out of reach." "I know," I said.
"I don't think you do."
"Mom," I snapped.
"Your dad wasn't perfect."
"I never assumed as much. God knows that I'd never even considered that he was perfect. I thought of his rigidness, of his push to mold Leo into something Leo never wanted to be." I blinked quickly to abate a rush of tears when I considered my own push to mold Leo into something he never was.
"She's not perfect either," my mom offered.
"It's me," I said, my voice breaking. "I'm the one who's turned everything to shit."
"Well," my mom said, "if you thought that you were a perfect specimen of man, you should have just come and asked me. I could have told you otherwise. Also, Ben, love, it goes both ways. You both probably turned things to shit."
I laughed because my mom never swears. At least, she never used to.
"Perfection's not the point, honey,"
she said before she returned to her weekend guests.
"Forgiveness is. Acceptance is."
Then,
"Maybe you can write about this."
I told her I was trying to. God, am I finally trying to? And then she said she loved me and hung up. She had her whole life now, too. And after Leo, I stopped begrudging that and instead tried to find comfort in her happiness. I rise from Joey's bed, my knees cracking, my empty stomach roiling from too much scotch. I shut his door tightly. Now all the doors are closed in the apartment, and though it's just as quiet as it was when they were open, I feel more settled. Like maybe the space is smaller. Like maybe I have less space to occupy. I root around the half-filled pantry for something for dinner. Joey's in a big soup phase, so I have a varied assortment. Corn chowder, split pea, tomato bisque. A far cry from the catered and gourmet meals that Tatum had sent to our house each morning, to adhere to her diet. I settle on 3-bean. I pop open the lid, which promptly gets stuck between the gelatinous soup and the side of the can, and I slice my thumb open as I try to pry it out. The blood rushes out quickly, faster than the pain hits my nervous system, and I'm momentarily stunned, wondering where this wound came from, wondering why it doesn't hurt more acutely. Then the pain comes, a sharp pinch radiating all the way up my arm. I suck on the cut and use my good hand to dump the soup into a bowl. I press the start button on the microwave and bend over, peering inside the oven as my soup goes round and round. The buzzer beeps when it finishes, but I stay there for a few seconds after, crouched, staring, still pressing my thumb against my tongue, unable to recognize that the time has passed, unable to recognize that the time is up before I'm even fully aware that it started.
4. Tatum, December 2000. Ben sneaks a small bottle of vodka from the inner pocket of his down coat, which is too puffy, and threatens to swallow his chin.
You saved my life. You know that, right?
He leans in close, shouting in my ear. You barely know me, I shout back. And you're already giving me credit for saving your life? He grins and shakes his head. Around us, the crowd's cheers rise in swells that envelop us and carry us up with them.
It's a small miracle you got me here on New Year's Eve, he yells. This is a native New Yorker's worst nightmare.
Well, you said you'd do anything I wanted in return for doing your film for free. I gaze up toward the flashing billboards, the neon lights. This is what I wanted. Also, him. This is what I wanted to do with him. Times Square at midnight, with a boy I might want to kiss for the rest of the year by my side. I didn't really think he'd come. I didn't really think I'd ask. But when I'd called Piper, my little sister who was still back in Ohio and who would be spending her New Year's Eve in Bud Jones's basement, the same Bud Jones who got his nickname from the amount of pot he smoked in high school and who threw the same depressing New Year's Eve party with a flat keg and blinking multicolored lights looped in the shape of breasts, I realized I had to. I had to dance in Times Square at midnight. I had to celebrate that I was no longer relegated to Bud Jones's metaphorical basement. I had to celebrate how far I'd come. Ben had called a few weeks ago. We hadn't really spoken since that night at the bar. Sometimes I'd see him around the village and wave, a little stutter of the hand, but we always kept walking with a bob of our chins. But then Daisy got the chicken pox, and he needed an actress for his graduate film, and that was how he ended up being indebted to me and by my side in Times Square on New Year's Eve. Also, I really wanted to kiss him. He was single now. Daisy told me as much when I stopped over at her place with an oatmeal bath from Duane Reade and some trashy magazines. I'd gotten the chicken pox when I was 6, when the entire first grade went down for the count over a particularly brutal Ohio winter. My mom let me sit in front of the TV all day, and then 3 days later, Piper was covered in spots and joined me, and I was mostly miserable, but also happy that my mom had canceled her shifts at the hospital and snuggled next to us while we watched Kids Incorporated, or she tried to explain the drama on Days of Our Lives. He dumped his girlfriend. Daisy said, picking at a particularly gruesome blister on her left forearm, a while ago. So, totally single. Totally eligible. What happened? Something about how she applied to residencies only outside of New York. He broke it off before she moved out of the state and left him behind. He got drunk one night and rambled on about loyalty and how it was all he really wanted. Ouch, I said, because it wasn't as if I couldn't relate. I may have been the one to move out of state, but mostly it was because I was fleeing the life I wanted to leave behind. Leave behind the shame of Aaron Johnson, the football player I lost my virginity to in high school,
who I believed had loved me, but who ditched me a month later for Julie Seymour, a girl on the field hockey team, and utterly detonated my teenage confidence by refusing to return my calls, refusing to acknowledge me in the hallway or after school when he picked up an item at the pharmacy where I worked, under horrifying lighting and wearing a poop-colored apron, or with others like Brandon and Mark and Eddie in college, all of whom managed to strip me, piece by piece, slowly enough that the damage was almost undetectable, of whatever self-confidence with boys I had left after Aaron and all the chaos of my home life. All of whom somehow convinced me that the current version of myself wasn't exactly what they were looking for. That maybe if I was just a bit smarter, or just a bit skinnier, or just a bit prettier, they wouldn't have grown bored, or listless, or looked elsewhere. "He's a good guy," Daisy said, wincing, scratching with more fervor. "You shouldn't be doing that. It leaves scars." "We're actors," she replied. "Scars are what make us interesting." Tonight, Ben's younger brother, Leo, elbows his way through the New Year's Eve swarm and lands next to us, dragging a girl I don't know, but have been told is named Caroline, who is a freshman at Barnard. Leo's a sophomore at Columbia.
"My parents' second wind," Ben said. "The baby of the family in every way."
Tonight, Leo is just the right amount of tipsy, and it's impossible not to giggle when he stumbles and flattens himself against Ben to stop himself from falling, and then kisses his cheeks when he is steady.
"My big brother," he grins. "You're always looking out for me. Get him to tell you sometime about how he took the blame for my stash of pot freshman year in high school."
Ben shakes his head.
"Mom and Dad threatened to stop my tuition payments for college."
Leo laughs.
"Dad is always busting our balls. Just trying to bring out our potential,"
Ben says. And though I don't know him well, I can see he's deflecting.
"And mostly he's busting mine." "Well, that's what makes you the best big brother in the world,"
Leo crows. He looks toward me.
"I assume you are the lovely lady who somehow got my uptight brother into Times Square right now?"
"Tatum," I say, extending a gloved hand, which he ignores as he pulls me into a hug as if I'm family.
"This is the sickest thing I have ever done,"
Ben laughs.
"And that's a high threshold." "No, dude, seriously, don't be a downer. We're gonna remember this forever. Times Square in New York!"
He cups his gloves around his mouth and tilts his head toward the night sky.
"Hello, 2001! Let's see what you got!"
Caroline passes around an open bottle of champagne concealed in a paper bag, and we all drink generously, the bubbly matching our effervescent spirits, the alcohol warming us in the frigid Manhattan air. The wind kicks up, and the snow starts to fall, thick, pregnant flakes that feel like they'll stick almost immediately. Leo and Caroline huddle together, him wrapping his scarf around her and tugging her closer as if their lips are magnetic, each unable to be without the other. In seconds, Ben's wavy dark hair is frosted in white, and he reaches out and brushes a few errant flakes off my eyelashes. There must be 10,000 people in Times Square, and I peer up at the Jumbotron, wondering where we are in the sea of faces and bodies that are mashed together, a pulsing wave ready to flush out the previous year, hearken in a new one. Ben and I gape at Leo and Caroline for a beat, self-conscious, awkward in that new way when you're waiting for the other one to kiss you, when you're too new to each other, too unsure to do anything more than bite your lip or stare at your shoes.
"Leo's always been like this," he says. "All the girls in my grade thought he was the cutest. Imagine losing girls to your younger brother. And he was like 11.
"I find that hard to believe."
"I'm too nice a guy,"
he shakes his head.
"That was never Leo's problem."
Ah, the curse of the nice guy. I don't mention that Daisy told me she thought that breaking up with the medical school girlfriend gutted him through the summer, that Daisy told him to go out and screw a few randoms, but he chuckled and said that wasn't his style. And she had said, "Not a guy's style. Casual sex is every guy's style," which had made him blush a little deeper, laugh a little harder. "Well," I say now, I don't think you're that nice. I mean, you were a bit of a tyrant on the shoot.
I was the director. That's my job. I was trying to make the day, get the light. Also, since we're here and I'm being honest, I can admit to asking for an extra take or two because I thought you were so spectacular.